Francisco started to shiver. "I'm so cold," he complained. "But I know that infernal fever will return." As predicted, a few moments later the heavy sweating began anew. "Damn," he cursed. "This will kill me, this sickness. And the others have left me behind. They know I cannot keep up. They know there is no hope for me. I am doomed in this godforsaken place. We didn't even find the treasures of gold they swear is here. Do you survive this illness?" I gently asked. He was quiet, and we waited. "I died from this. I never leave the jungle. The fever kills me, and I never see my family again. They will be very grieved. My son is so young." The sweat on Pedro's face was now mixed with his tears. He was grieving his early death, alone in an alien land, from a strange disease that no sailor's skill could defeat. I had him detach from Francisco's body, and he floated in a state of calm and tranquility, freed from the fever and pain, beyond grief and suffering. His face was much more peaceful and relaxed, and I let him rest. I pondered this pattern of losses in Pedro's lifetimes. So many separations from his loved ones. So much grief. As he made his way through the uncertain and nebulous mists of time, would he be able to find them again? Would he find all them? Pedro's lifetimes contained many patterns, not just losses. In this regression, he remembered being a Spaniard, but he had also been an English soldier, killed by the Spanish enemy when his forces invaded their fortress. He remembered being male, and he remembered being female. He had experienced lifetimes as a warrior and lifetimes as a priest. He had lost people, and he had found them. After he had died as a monk, surrounded by his spiritual family, Pedro had reviewed the lessons of that lifetime. "Forgiveness is so important," he had told me. "We have all done those things for which we condemn others. We must forgive them." His lives illustrated his message. He had to learn from all sides in order to truly understand. We all do. We change religions, races, and nationalities. We experience lifetimes of extreme wealth and of abject poverty, of sickness and of health. We must learn to reject all prejudice and hatred. Those who do not will simply switch sides, returning in the bodies of their enemies. In his song Tears in Heaven, Eric Clapton wonders whether his young son, who had tragically died in an accident, would know his name if they met in heaven. His is a universal and ageless question. How will we recognize our loved ones? Will we know them, and will they know us, if and when we meet again, whether in heaven or on earth, once more in physical bodies? Many of my patients just seem to know. When experiencing their past lives, they look into a soul companion's eyes, and they know. Whether in heaven or on earth, they sense a vibration or energy, and it is the same as their loved ones. They glimpse the deeper personality, and there is an inner knowing, a knowing from the heart. A connection is made. Because it is the heart's eyes that often see first, words alone cannot convey the confidence of soul recognition. There is no wavering or confusion. Even though the body may be very different from the current one, the soul is the same. The soul is recognized, and the recognition is complete and beyond any doubt. Sometimes soul recognition may originate in the mind and may occur even before the heart sees. This type of recognition happens most often with babies or young children. They exhibit some physical mannerism or unique behavior, they utter a word or phrase, and a beloved parent or grandparent is instantly recognized. They may have an identical scar or birthmark as your loved one, or perhaps just hold your hand or look at you in that same special way. You know. In heaven, there are no birthmarks. Would Eric Clapton's son help him there? The song asks. Would he hold Eric's hand? Would he help him stand? In heaven, where physical bodies are not needed, soul recognition may occur through an inner knowing, a sense of a loved one's special energy, light, or vibration. You feel them, in your heart. There is a deep and intuitive wisdom there, and you recognize them completely and immediately. They may even help you by assuming the body they had during their last incarnation with you. You see them as they appeared to you on Earth, often younger and healthier. Clapton concludes that he will find peace beyond heaven's door. Whether beyond the door to heaven, The daughter remembering past lifetimes together, or the door leading to future lifetimes with your loved ones, you will never be alone. They will know your name. They will hold your hand. They will bring peace and healing to your heart. Over and over, my patients, while deeply hypnotized, tell me that death is not an accident. When babies and young children die, we are given the opportunity to learn important lessons. They are teachers to us, teaching us about values, priorities, and, most of all, about love. Often the most important lessons arise from the most difficult times. Chapter 13. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting, and cometh from afar, not in entire forgetfulness and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy. William Wordsworth. Despite her success in recalling several past lives, Elizabeth still ached with grief. Intellectually, she had begun to accept the concept of the continuity of the soul and the recurrence of consciousness in subsequent physical bodies. She had experienced the reunion of soul companions along this journey. But memories did not bring her mother back, not physically. She could not hug her and talk to her. She missed her mother dearly. As Elizabeth came into the office for today's session, I decided to try something different, something I had done with varying degrees of success with other patients. As usual, I would help her achieve a state of deep relaxation. I would then guide her in visualizing a beautiful garden, have her walk into the garden, and rest. As she was resting, I would suggest that a visitor was joining her in the garden and that Elizabeth could communicate with this visitor in thoughts, voice, vision, feelings, or in any other way. Everything that Elizabeth experienced after this point would come from her own mind, not from my suggestions. She sank deeply into the familiar leather recliner and quickly entered the tranquil hypnotic state. I counted backward from 10 to 1, deepening her level even more. She imagined herself walking down a spiral staircase. As she reached the bottom of the steps, she visualized the garden in front of her. She walked into the garden and found a place to rest. I told her about the visitor, and we waited. After a short while, she became aware that a beautiful light was approaching her. In the quiet office, Elizabeth began to cry softly. "Why are you crying?" I questioned. "It's my mother. I can see her in the light. She looks so beautiful, so young." Now speaking directly to her mother, she added, "It's so good to see you." Elizabeth was smiling and crying at the same time. "You can talk to her, you can communicate with her," I reminded Elizabeth. I did not say anything more at this point as I didn't want to interfere with the reunion. Elizabeth was not recalling a memory, nor was she re-experiencing some event that had already occurred. This experience was happening now. The meeting with her mother was taking place vividly and emotionally in Elizabeth's mind. That their reunion existed so powerfully in her mind conferred a considerable degree of reality to her experience. The potential to help her heal her grief was now present. We sat quietly for several minutes, the silence sometimes punctuated by small sighs. At times I could see a tear roll down Elizabeth's cheek. She smiled frequently. Finally, she began to speak. "She is gone now," Elizabeth said very calmly. "She had to go, but she will be back." Elizabeth remained deeply relaxed with her eyes still closed as we continued to talk. "Did she communicate with you?" I asked. "Yes, she told me many things. She told me to trust in myself. She said, 'Trust in yourself. I have taught you everything you need to know. What does this mean to you?'" "That I must believe in my own feelings and not let others influence me all the time. Especially men," she replied emphatically. "She said that men have taken advantage of me because I didn't believe in myself enough, and I let them. I gave them too much power, robbing myself at the same time. I must stop doing this. We are all the same," she told me. "Souls are not male or female. You are as beautiful and as powerful as any other soul in the universe. Do not forget this, do not become distracted by their physical forms." This is what she said. "Did she tell you anything else?" "Yes, there is more," she answered, but did not elaborate. "What?" I prodded. That she loves me dearly, Elizabeth added in a delicate way. That she is fine. She is helping many souls on the other side. She will still always be there for me. There was one more thing. What is that? To be patient. Something will happen very soon, something important. And I must trust in myself. What will happen? I don't know, she answered softly. But when it does, I will trust myself, she added with a resolve I had never noticed in her before. Sitting in the green room of the Donahue show, I witnessed a stunningly surrealistic scene. There was Jenny Cockle, a 41-year-old woman from England, sitting with her son, Sonny, age 75, and her daughter, Phyllis, who was 69 years old at the time. Their story is far better and more convincing than Bride A. Murphy's, a famous landmark reincarnation case. Ever since her early childhood, Jenny knew that in a recent past life she had died suddenly, leaving her 8 children virtual orphans. She knew detailed facts about their early 20th century lives in rural Ireland. Her name in that life was Mary. Jenny's family humored her, but there were not enough funds or interest to investigate the child's fantastic stories of a life of crushing poverty and tragedy in Ireland decades ago. Jenny grew up not knowing if her vivid recollections were real or not. Finally, Jenny had the resources to begin her research. She found 5 of the 8 children of Mary Sutton, an Irish woman who died in 1932 from complications after the birth of her 8th child. Mary Sutton's children confirmed many of Jenny's incredibly detailed memories. They seemed convinced that Jenny was indeed Mary, their dead mother. And I was watching their ongoing reunion, there in the green room of the Donahue show. My mind shifted gears and I saw the beginning sequence of the old Ben Casey television show. This was a medical show in the late 50s or early 60s. My mother, in her subtle way, encouraged me to watch this program, relentlessly influencing me to choose medicine as my career. The Ben Casey show always began with universal symbols, and the aged neurosurgeon mentor of the young Dr. Ben Casey intoned, man, woman, birth, death, infinity, or something very much like this. Universal mysteries, unanswerable riddles. Sitting in the green room just prior to going on Donahue as an expert on past life memories, I was getting the answers that had eluded young Ben Casey and all the others. Man? Woman? In the course of our lifetimes, we change sexes, religions, and races in order to learn from all sides. We are all in school here. Birth? If we never really die, then we are never really born. We are all immortal, divine, and indestructible. Death is nothing more than walking through a door into another room. We keep returning in order to learn certain lessons, or traits, such as love, forgiveness, understanding, patience, awareness, non-violence. We have to unlearn other traits, such as fear, anger, greed, hatred, pride, ego, which result from old conditioning. Then we can graduate and leave this school. We have all the time in the world to learn and unlearn. We are immortal, we are infinite, we have the nature of God. As I watched Jenny and her aged children, even more came to me. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. The concept of karma is stated virtually word for word in all the great religions. This wisdom is ancient. We are responsible to ourselves, to others, to the community, and to the planet. Propelled by her need to care for and to protect her children, Jenny was pulled back to them once again. We never lose our loved ones. We keep coming back, together and together again. What a powerful reuniting energy love is. Chapter 14. My doctrine is, live so that thou mayest desire to live again. That is thy duty, for in any case thou wilt again. Nietzsche. There are many bridges, or techniques, for helping a patient remember past lives through hypnosis. One of these bridges is a door. Often I will put patients into a deep hypnotic trance and have them walk through a door they choose, a door into a past lifetime. Imagine yourself standing in a beautiful corridor or hallway, with large and magnificent doors on either side and at the ends. These are doorways into your past, even into your past lives. They may lead you to spiritual experiences. As I count backward from 5 to 1, one of these doors will open, a door to your past. This door will pull you. It will attract you. Go to it. 5. The door is opening. This door will help you to understand any blocks or obstacles to joy and happiness in your current life. Go to the door. 4. You are at the door. You see a beautiful light on the other side of the door. Step through the door and into the light. 3. Go through the light. You are in another time and another place. Do not worry about what is imagination, fantasy, actual memory, symbol, metaphor, or some combination of all of these. It is the experience that matters. Just let yourself experience whatever pops into your mind. Try not to think, judge, or critique. Just let yourself experience. Whatever comes into your awareness is fine. You can analyze it later. 2. Nearly there, nearly through the light. When I say 1, be there and join the person or scene on the other side of the light. Let it all come into focus on the count of 1. 1. Be there. Look at your feet and see what kind of footwear you are wearing. Look at your clothes, your skin, your hands. Are they the same or different? Pay attention to details. The door is just one of many bridges to the past. All lead to the same place, to a past life or a spiritual experience that is important to the person's current life situation. Elevators traveling back through time, a road or pathway or even an actual bridge through the mists of time, stepping across a creek, brook, stream, or small river to the other side, to another lifetime, a time machine, with the patient operating the control panel. These are just a few examples of a myriad pathways or bridges to the past. For Pedro, I use the doorways. When he tried to look at his feet after emerging from the light, he found himself staring instead at the large stone mask of a god. He has a long nose and large angled teeth. The mouth, lips, are strange, very large and wide. His eyes are round and set deeply and far apart. He has a very mean look. The gods can be cruel. How do you know this is a god? He is very powerful. Are there many gods, or is he the only one? There are many, but he is a powerful one. He controls the rain. Without rain we could not grow food, Pedro explained simply. Are you there? Can you find yourself? I urged. I'm there. I'm a priest of some sort. I know about the heavens and the sun, moon, and stars. I help to make the calendars. Where do you do this work? In a building made of stone. It has stairs that circle around and small windows through which we see and measure. It's very complicated. But I'm good at this. They rely on me for the measurements. I know when the eclipses will occur. It sounds as if this is a very scientific civilization, I commented. Only parts of it. The astronomy and the architecture. The rest is superstitious and backward, he clarified. There are other priests and their supporters who are only interested in power. They use superstitions and fear to delude the people and maintain their power. They are supported by nobles who help to control the warriors. It's an alliance to keep power in the hands of only a few. The time and the culture Pedro remembered may have been ancient, but the techniques of control and the political alliances formed to gain and maintain power are timeless. The ambitions of men never seem to change. How do they use superstitions to delude the people? They blame the gods for natural events. Then they blame the people for angering or displeasing the gods. So the people become responsible for natural events, like floods or droughts or earthquakes or volcanic eruptions. When the people are not to blame at all. And neither the gods. These are events of nature and not the actions of angry gods. But the people do not realize this. They stay ignorant and fearful because they feel responsible for these calamities. Pedro paused for a few moments, then he continued. It's a mistake to externalize our problems, our calamities, to the gods. This gives the priests and nobles too much power. We understand more about natural events than the people do. We usually know when they begin and when they end. We understand about the cycles. An eclipse is a natural event that can be calculated and predicted. It's not an act of anger or punishment by the gods. But that is what they tell the people. Pedro was speaking rapidly now, Words and concepts poured from him without my prodding. The priests hold themselves out as the communicators to the gods. They tell the people they are the only intermediaries, that they know what the gods want. I know this is not true. I am one of the priests. He thought silently for a moment. Go on, I suggested. The priests have developed a cruel and elaborate system of sacrifices to appease the gods. His voice dropped to a whisper. Even sacrifices of people. Of people? I echoed. Yes, he whispered. They do not have to do this often, because it strikes such fear into the people. There are rituals for drowning and rituals for slaying. As if gods need human blood. Pedro's voice was rising as anger crept in. They manipulate the people with rituals of fear. They even choose who is to be sacrificed. This gives them as much power as their gods. They choose who is to live and who must die. Do you have to take part in the ritual sacrifices? I cautiously asked him. No, he answered. I do not believe in them. They let me stay with my observations and calculations. I do not even believe that these gods exist, he whispered in a confidential way. You don't? No. How can gods be as petty and foolish as people? When I observe the heaven and the beautiful harmony of the sun and moon, the planets and the stars, how can such an intelligence, such a wisdom, be petty and foolish at the same time? It makes no sense. We give these so-called gods our own qualities. Fear, anger, jealousy, hatred, these are ours and we project them onto these gods. I believe the real God is far beyond human emotions. The real God does not need our rituals and sacrifices. This ancient incarnation of Pedro possessed great wisdom. He talked easily, even of taboo subjects, and he did not seem tired, so I decided to press ahead. Do you ever become more influential as a priest? I asked. Do you gain more power in that lifetime? No, I don't, he responded. I would not rule like that if I had power. I would educate the people. I would let them learn for themselves. I would stop the sacrifices. But the priests and nobles might lose their power, I objected. What if the people stopped listening? They would not, he said. Real power comes from knowledge. Real wisdom is applying that knowledge in a caring and benevolent manner. The people are ignorant, but that can change. They are not stupid. The priest was teaching me about spiritual politics, and I could feel the truth in his words. Go on, I requested, after another period of silence. There is no more, Pedro answered. I have left that body, and I am resting. This surprised me. I had not asked him to leave. We had not experienced a death scene, and there was no jarring or traumatic event that might have spontaneously dislodged him. I remembered that he had entered this lifetime in an unusual way, confronting the huge stone face of the God of Rain. Perhaps there was nothing more to be gained from examining that lifetime any further, and Pedro's higher mind knew this. And so he left. He would have been the marvelous ruler. In November of 1992, Galileo was exonerated by the Church for his accursed heresy, which held that the Earth was not the nucleus of the universe but that in fact the Earth revolved around the Sun. The investigation that cleared Galileo began in 1980 and lasted for 12.5 years. The work of the Inquisition in 1633 was finally undone 359 years later. Unfortunately, closed-mindedness is often undone even more slowly. All institutions seem to be closed-minded. Individuals who never question their assumptions and belief systems are similarly closed-minded. How can they assimilate new observations and new knowledge when their minds are blinded by beliefs and by untested old ideas? Years ago, while in a deep trance state, Catherine told me, "Our task is to learn, to become God-like through knowledge. We know so little, by knowledge we approach God, and then we can rest. Then we come back to teach and help others." Knowledge can only flow into minds that are open. Chapter 15, I know I am deathless. No doubt I have died myself 10,000 times before. I laugh at what you call dissolution, and I know the amplitude of time. Walt Whitman. Dreams have many functions. They help to process and integrate the day's events. They provide clues, often in the form of symbols and metaphors, that help solve the problems of everyday life relationships, fears, work, emotions, illnesses, and much more. They can assist us in achieving our desires and goals, if not physically then at least in the form of wish fulfillment. They aid us in reviewing past events, reminding us of parallels in the present. They protect sleep by disguising stimuli such as anxieties that would otherwise awaken us. Dreams have deeper functions as well. They may provide pathways to recovering repressed or forgotten memories, whether from childhood, infancy, in utero experiences, or even from past lives. Past life memory fragments often emerge in the dream state, particularly in those dreams in which the dreamer sees scenes from the years or centuries preceding his or her birth. Dreams can be psychic or precognitive. Often these particular dreams can predict the future. Accuracy varies because the future appears to be a system of probabilities and inevitabilities, and because the ability of people to accurately interpret their dreams itself varies tremendously. These psychic or precognitive dreams are experienced by many people of all cultures and backgrounds. However, many people are shocked when their dreams literally come true. Another type of psychic dream occurs when communication with a person at a distance is experienced. The person may be alive and geographically distant, or the communication may be with the soul or consciousness of someone who has died, such as a relative or dear friend. Similarly, there may be communication with an angelic spirit, a teacher, or a guide. The messages in these dreams are usually genuinely moving and very important. Traveling dreams also occur. During these dreams, people have the experience of visiting places to which they have never physically been. Details of what they see can later be confirmed. When the person actually visits the geographical place, even months or years after the dream, a feeling of déjà vu or familiarity may occur. Sometimes the dream traveler visits places that do not seem to exist on this planet. These dreams may be far more than nocturnal imaginings. They may be mystical or spiritual experiences, accessed because the usual ego and cognitive barriers are relaxed during sleep and dreaming. Knowledge and wisdom acquired during this type of traveling dream can transform lives. On this day, when night lightened into morning, Elizabeth had one of these dreams. Elizabeth bounced in early for her appointment, eager to tell me about the dream she had during the previous night. She appeared less anxious and more relaxed than I had ever seen her. People at work, she told me, had begun to comment that she looked better, that she was being nicer and more patient, even more so than the old Elizabeth, before her mother's death. This was not one of my typical dreams, she stressed. This dream was more alive and real. I still remember all the details, and I usually forget most of my dreams pretty quickly, as you know. I had been encouraging Elizabeth to write down her dreams as soon as she awakened. Keeping a dream journal near your bed and jotting down what you remember of your dream significantly enhances the memory. Otherwise, the dream content fades rapidly away. Elizabeth had been somewhat lazy about chronicling her dreams, and by the time she came to the office for her appointment, she had usually forgotten most of the details, if not the entire dream. This dream was different, so vivid that the details were etched in her mind. At first, I entered a large room. There were no windows or lamps or overhead lights. But the walls were somehow glowing. They emitted enough light to illuminate the entire room. Were the walls hot? I asked. I don't think so. They gave off light but not heat. I didn't touch the walls though. What else did you notice in the room? I knew it was a library of some sort, but I couldn't see any shelves or any books. In the corner of the room was a statue of the Sphinx. There were two old chairs on either side of this statue, old from an olden time. They were not from modern times, almost like a throne made out of stone or marble. She was quiet for a moment, her gaze drifting upward and to the left as she remembered the ancient chairs. What do you think a statue of the Sphinx was doing there? I inquired. I don't know. Maybe because the library helped you to understand secrets. I remembered the riddle of the Sphinx. What walks on four legs in the morning, two legs during the day, and three legs at night? Man does. A crawling baby becomes an adult who becomes elderly, needing a cane to walk. Maybe it has something to do with that riddle. Or with riddles in general.